During the afternoon session, if you feel like you need to take a nap, go right ahead and do that. We've learned to do it with our eyes open. I nap a while and while Joe talks, and he naps a while I talk, and you all might as well join the crowd and nap some too. We finished up the session before lunch, a chapter more about alcoholism. And in the chapter more about alcoholism, we learned that the insanity that we have to be restored from is the insane idea that this time it's going to be different. This time we're just going to have a couple of drinks. Or this time we're going to drink and everything will be okay. Believing the lie, and based upon the lie, we take the drink. And then the allergy takes over, and then we end up drunk and sick every time. And in that chapter more about alcoholism, he really closes the door on us. He lets us know just exactly what's going to happen to us if we don't find this power greater than human power, this God as we understand him, or whatever we prefer to call it. Now, if you're the kind of alcoholic that I am, if you were raised in the church setting that I was raised in, at the end of chapter 3, you're really faced with one hell of a dilemma. Because I could recognize without finding God or getting God in my life that I would probably go back to drinking again. I was also absolutely convinced that I would be unable to do so. You see, I was raised in a good old Southern Baptist church. In a good old Southern Baptist church, when I was a kid growing up, I'm sure they talked about a kind and a loving God once in a while. But if they did, the message never got to the pew that I sat in. Because all I remember as a kid growing up in church about God was hell, fire, and damnation. Going to hell for lying and cheating and stealing and drinking whiskey and committing adultery. And by the time I'd got to AA, I'd been doing that for about 26 years. And I knew that God had already told St. Peter, when that little four-eyed sucker gets up here sitting him downstairs, we'll not need his kind. And I was convinced that if God was going to have anything to do with me, period, it wouldn't be anything good, it would be something bad. You know, I remember so clearly when I separated from God and separated from the church. When I was going to church as a young boy, they told me the things I could do and what I couldn't do. And they said, if you do this, this, and this, you'll be okay. If you do that, that, and that, you're going to go to hell just sure as anything. And I didn't have any trouble with their rules at all until I got to be about 12 or 13 years old. And I remember one day the minister looked me straight in the eye. And he said, son, to think about doing it is just as bad as doing it. And I thought, oh, crap, I've had it now. Because I'd been thinking about doing it for about a year. In fact, I'd been thinking about doing it so long I was starting to get a little brain damage from it. And I said to myself, if you're going to go to hell for thinking about doing it,
might as well do it.
Then you might as well just go ahead and do it. And I did it. And I didn't go to hell immediately. And I said to myself, that sucker has been lying to me all along. And I made up my mind that day that that minister and my parents and my teachers had joined together in a conspiracy to keep me from having any fun at all. And I said, from this day on, I'm not going to pay any attention to any of them. From this day on, I'm going to do whatever I want to do, whenever I want to do it, and I'm going to have a good time while I'm doing it, and if they don't like it, they can all go to hell. And I left God, and I left the Baptist church, and I left any kind of parental control or any other control when I was about 13 years old. And when I came to AA, I was 38 years old. And I came here with the spiritual knowledge of this 13-year-old boy who had defied God, his parents, his teachers, and everybody else. No wonder people like us are screwed up in our relationship with God when we get here. And thank God Bill Wilson is a real alcoholic. Because Bill had the same kind of problems with this God thing that I did. And I think Bill probably said to himself, after writing chapter 3, he probably said, "These rest of these guys are not going to care any more about this God thing than I did." And he said, "It's not going to be very long, and they're going to be faced with a decision about this God thing. And based on old ideas, they would be unable to make that decision, period." And I think he said to himself, "Maybe I better give them some new ideas about God so they can discard some of those old ideas they learned as a kid growing up. And then maybe they'll be able to make a decision about this God thing." And he sits down and he writes another chapter, and he called it We Agnostics. And I think it's one of the greatest pieces of spiritual information I've ever read in my life. I find nowhere in this chapter does it try to prove to me that there's any particular kind of God, period. I find what it does do for me is give me some new ideas about God so I can discard some old ideas about God. And then God has proven to me that there is a kind and a loving God. I don't think I could ever have made the decision about God without the chapter, We Agnostics. Thank God for it. I think it's one of the best things I've ever read, Joe.
Thank you, Charlie. I'm like Charlie. I got here. I had the spiritual knowledge of a 7-year-old boy, and you can imagine what that was. I told you, somewhat like Charlie's was. And Bill was just like us. He had a problem with this idea about God. Remember, he said that when they talk of a God personal to me, he said, my mind snapped shut against such theories. And that was Bill's experience. So he wrote this chapter, We Agnostics, for people like me and Charlie and probably some of you. But the word agnostic means a great deal to me, because Gnostic means knowledge. And you put the ag in front of it, means without. Those of us who are without knowledge, or the knowledge that we do have, is that of a young child. And that's what I had when I got here. And I had no way I could turn my will, my life over to that God then, or when I got here, or now. So I had to have another understanding of God. And I'm like Charlie. This chapter, We Agnostics, is put in here to give me some new ideas about the God, to think about this God deal, and to wonder about it. And I found that as I look back at it, the result of that was my mind opened up to a point that I could let God into my mind, and God has taught me about God. See, that's a marvelous idea for me. My understanding of God is nowhere near like it was when I first got here. I couldn't have done that. And our book says earlier, a little bit later in our book, it says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. The spiritual malady. And that means our idea about God. And so this chapter, Agnostic, is here for that purpose, to give us some new ideas, so that God might prove us to us that there's a God. And once that happens, no one could improve on our understanding. We'll have a God of our own understanding. And I like that idea. So on page 44, if we will, We Agnostics. He said, in the preceding chapter, you have learned something about alcoholism. We hope we've made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely,
that's because of the obsession of the mind.
Or if, when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take,
that's because of the physical allergy of the body,
you are probably alcoholic. Now, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness, which only a spiritual experience will conquer.
We just love the simplicity of the big book. You know, two little questions to determine if we're alcoholic or not. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. Or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, then you are probably alcoholic. Now, what could be more simple than that? But you see how people love to expand on stuff. Our fellowship has taken these two little simple questions out of the big book, and that wasn't enough, so they came out with a pamphlet, I think, that had 10 questions in it. And then later on, that wasn't enough, and they came out with another one with about 20 questions in it. Hell, I think today they're up to 44 questions to determine if you're alcoholic. I'm sure glad that Ebby didn't have the 44 questions when he walked into Bill's kitchen. Old Bill sitting there about 2/3 drunk, hung over, felt like hell. He would have said, Bill, has alcohol been bothering your reputation? He hadn't had a reputation for years. And then he would have said, Bill, has alcohol been interfering with your sex life? If he's anything like I was, he hadn't had any of that in a long time either. He would have confused the hell out of Bill. Now, we just need these two little simple questions. I use them all the time. People come to me today and they say, Charlie, you think I might be an alcoholic? I think, why don't? I say, I don't know. Let me ask you a couple questions. I say, have you been able to quit drinking entirely, left on your own resources? If they're a real alcoholic, they got to say no. And then I say, do you have any control over the amount you drink after you once start drinking? If they're a real alcoholic, they got to say no. And then I say, well, you're probably an alcoholic. And it's just that simple. Joe and I had an old friend that used to live down in Tyler, Texas. His name was Wino Joe. And I've always felt sorry for anybody in AA that didn't get to meet Wino Joe. Wino Joe was a real character. And he made up his own list of questions to ask yourself to see if you're alcoholic. And the first question on his list was, has the roof of your mouth ever been sunburned?
Wow, thank you.
He said, if it has, you're probably an alcoholic. His second question was, have you ever been arrested for drunk driving from the back seat of somebody else's car? And the third one that I always loved, have you ever been arrested for public drunk while in jail? He said, if you have, you're probably alcoholic. Why not add a list of
Joe
we just to, need to.
Joe used to lay out in those cotton fields in West Texas and drink that wine. He lay there with his mouth open and the roof of his mouth would get sunburned. That's why he asked that question.
You know, we are very unique people when you really start thinking about this thing. We number amongst a few people in the world today that have an illness of both the body and the mind that can only be overcome by a spiritual experience. We also number amongst a few people in the world today who have a terminal illness that we can come out of it in better shape than we were when we went into it if we can have this spiritual experience. And our book tells us, to one who feels he's atheist or agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he's an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. To be doomed to an alcoholic death,
which is step one,
or to live on a spiritual basis,
step two,
are not always easy alternatives to face. But it isn't so difficult. About half our original fellowship were of exactly that type. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope we were not true alcoholics. But after a while, we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. Perhaps it's going to be that way with you. But cheer up, something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostics, and our experience shows that you need not be disconcerted. And I think what Bill's really saying to us here, it doesn't make much difference what you believe when you get here. You may think you're an atheist, you may think you're an agnostic. It really doesn't make any difference. We're still going to be able to have the spiritual experience. And I know for me, when I got to this part of the book and began to read these pages here, once again, I had to go back to the dictionary and look up some of these words and see what they really mean. For instance, I went to the dictionary and I looked up the word atheist. And the dictionary defines an atheist as one who says there is no God, period. Now, if an atheist really believes that, and really believes there's no power greater than human power, then a spiritual experience would seem to be an impossibility. Because the true atheist would have no power greater than human power to turn to. And they would have to stand on their own two feet, make their own decisions, and rule their own destiny. I said, Charlie, are you an atheist? And I said, no, I'm not an atheist. I've always believed in some kind of God, as far back as I can remember. So certainly I'm not an atheist. And I thought, well, then maybe you're an agnostic. So I had to go to the dictionary and look that word up too. And like Joe said a while ago, the word agnostic means one who is without knowledge, without knowledge of God. And I found that I believed in God, but I had no knowledge of God because I had never really turned to God for help, never turned to God for direction, never received God's power in my life. So even though I believed in God, I didn't know anything at all about God and God's power. And since I had never turned to God for help, then I found that I had to act like the atheist acted. I stood on my own two feet, run my own show, ruled my own destiny, even though I believed there was a God there. And I said, Charlie, surely, surely, you're an agnostic. And I think that's the way most of us get here at AA. I've never met a real, true atheist in AA. Even those I've met that profess to be atheists, they believe in evolution, and that if that isn't a proof of a power greater than human power, I don't know what is. I think most of us get here believing in God, but acting as if we disbelieve, running our own show, making our own decisions, ruling our own destiny, and even though we believe in God, we don't know God, simply because we haven't turned to God for the power and for the help and for the etc. But I think most of us come here as agnostics. The big book says if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. We alcoholics are not drunken bums. A drunken bum is just about where they want to be. They're not too interested in changing the situation. But I've never met a good alcoholic yet that didn't have a philosophy of life and a set of morals. And we will be there with a drunken bum, but we don't want to be there. We know the difference between right and wrong. We know what we should be doing, what we shouldn't be doing. And if our philosophy of life and our set of morals would have saved us, many of us would have recovered from alcoholism a long time ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might. But the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, and that's what the atheist and agnostic has been working on, human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? I think that is so true. Lack of power. That was our dilemma. We came to AA simply because we could find no other resources that would solve our problem for us. If you and I could have solved our problem through our own power, we would have solved it a long time ago. AA is the court of last resort. We came here because there was no place else left to go. I've never seen anybody in AA yet that said, I took a drink when I was 14 years old, jumped up and down, shouted with joy, and said, I can hardly wait to be a member of AA when I'm 38 years old. No, we came here because everything else failed. If you and I could have found the answer elsewhere, we wouldn't be members of AA. So certainly lack of power is our problem. Now the book says, well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. It doesn't say which will enable you to solve your problem. It doesn't say which will enable you to find that power and then go about solving the problem yourself. It says the main object is to enable you to find the power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. So I find from page 45 on, for those of us who are powerless, whether we be atheist or agnostic doesn't make any difference. For those of us who are powerless, how do you find the power? From page 45 on, we don't talk about alcohol anymore. We talk about how do you find the power. And if we can find the power, then the power is going to solve the problem, Joe.
Let's go back to page 46 for a moment, please.
Somewhere we have to start the finding of the power. Somewhere we have to start discarding old ideas, accepting new ideas. And the book tells us where to begin.
First paragraph said, yes, we of agnostic temperament have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice, which is old ideas, and my ideas about God were 7 years old, lay those aside, and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results. Even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God, much to our relief, we discovered that we did not need to consider another conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and effective contact with Him.
Here's the first old idea cast aside. See, I was taught as that kid growing up in church that you had to believe as they believed. And if you believe different than that, you're going to go to hell just sure as anything. And it's very comforting for me to find out that I don't have to consider another person's concept of God, that I can have my own concept, however inadequate it may be, and that is the starting point for the finding of the power. An old idea cast aside, replaced with a new idea, and now I'm ready to begin the process of the finding of the power.
Well, my sponsor at the time recognized I was having trouble with this, and he said, Joe, you're having trouble with this idea about God, aren't you? I said, I sure am. He said, why don't you go home tonight and get your pencil and piece of paper out and realize you can't make God, but if you could, what would you want God to be? Just write that down. What you would like God to be. So I went home that night and I wrote down some things that I wanted God to be, and I'm not going to tell you what they are. They're things for me. And I wrote them down, and I took them back to George, and I said, well, I'd like God to do this. He said, that's good, Joe. You can start there. See, I didn't know you could do that. I'm like, Charlie, man, you go to hell in the South for doing that. You have to believe as they believe, or you're going quick. They won't let you do that. But this guy gave me the permission to start with that, and I needed that permission, and I started right there. And it says, as soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. We found that God does not make too hard a terms with those who seek Him. To us, the realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men.
Another old idea cast aside. I was taught that the way to God is a very straight and a very narrow path. If you veer off either side of it, you're going to hell just sure as anything. And my book is telling me now that that isn't necessarily true. It said that we found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek Him. To us, the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding of those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men. Another old idea cast aside, replaced with a new idea. Already my concept about God is beginning to change just through the reading of a couple of paragraphs here in the book.
I asked him, you mean I need to find God? He said, Joe, God's not lost. He said, what you need to do is seek God in your life. He said, down here is We found that God does not make too hard a term for those who seek Him. To us, the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. He said it's in the seeking. It's not in the finding. So if I will seek God in my life, I will see God in my life. It's in the seeking, not in the finding.
If you've been here since the beginning of time, it's kind of hard to get lost.
It sure is.
I don't think God's lost either. Yeah. Page 47. Yeah.
So when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice.
Remember, prejudice is old ideas.
You may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. At the start, this was all that we needed to commence spiritual growth. To affect our first conscious relation to God as we understood Him. Then afterwards, we found ourselves accepting many things which then seemed entirely out of reach. That was growth, but if we wished to grow, we had to begin somewhere. So we use our own conception, however limited it was. I had to start somewhere. George gave me the permission to start at a very simple level, and I needed that permission. That was the beginning, and I needed that. Now we need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe?
The agnostic has always believed.
Or am I even willing to believe?
The atheist can become willing to believe.
That there's a power greater than myself. And my sponsor said, if you can't find a power greater than yourself, at least find one other than yourself. I can do that. And as soon as a man can say that he does believe.
Agnostic.
Or is willing to believe.
Atheist.
We emphatically assure him that he is on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. Again, the asterisks, please be sure to read Appendix 2 on spiritual experience. And we'll make us know that we need to understand what they mean by those terms.
Okay, now through the use of the asterisk, he's tied this wonderfully effective spiritual structure that we're going to build. He's tied that together with a spiritual experience. And actually, that's what we're going to be building as we progress through the steps. And we're going to find that we don't have to wait till we get to step 12 to get something out of this thing. Every step that we take will be another step in the building of the spiritual experience. Now he says this, it has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, the cornerstone of believing or being willing to believe, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. We talked once before in Bill's story when he said willingness was the foundation. Now he tells us that believing, step 2, is the cornerstone. A little later on, as we work some more steps, he'll tell us exactly what we're building and we're going to pass through it to freedom. So we're already in the process of building the wonderfully effective spiritual structure. We're in the process of having the spiritual experience. If we can say to ourselves, you betcha I believe, or if I can say to myself, I am willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself, then I'm emphatically assured that I'm already on the way to the finding of the power, to the having the spiritual experience. Jesus. Now listen to what he says. That was great news for us, for we had assumed we could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things on faith which seemed difficult to believe. Now right here he separates the words belief and faith. And one of my problems as a kid growing up in church is the minister always said, son, all you got to do is have faith and you'll be okay. Well, faith implies surety. Faith implies knowledge. And I never was sure, nor did I have the knowledge, that God would restore me to sanity or do anything else for me that was good. The best I can possibly do is to start with belief. Belief is upfront information. Belief can be nothing more than suspicion. Faith is after-the-fact information. Faith is surety and knowledge. Let me give you an example. Let's say that I moved into this area of the country here. Maybe 90 days after I move into here, I've got a problem with my automobile. I don't know a good mechanic anywhere in this area. But you've lived here for years, and I'm pretty sure you'll know somebody. Take your car over there to Jack. Jack will do you a good job, and he'll charge you a reasonable price. Well, I don't know whether that's true or not. The best I can do with that information is if I believe it's strong enough, I'll take my car over there to Jack. And sure enough, Jack does a good job and charges me a reasonable price. When I leave there, I know that he will do that. When I went there, I believed he would do it based on what you told me. But when I leave there, I know he will do it based upon fact. Now, 6 months ago, I have trouble with my car again. And I don't ask you or anybody else where to take it. I take it right back to Jack. Only this time I took it on faith. This time I took it on knowledge. And one of our great problems with spirituality is too many people are trying to start with faith. And we can't start with faith. We can only start with belief. I came to believe a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. That step does not say I came to know or I was sure. It simply says I came to believe. So if I can say to myself, yes, I believe there's a power greater than I am. Or if I'm an atheist, if I can say, you betcha, I'm willing to believe there's a power greater than I am, then I'm already on the road to recovery. That's the starting point, Joe.
Let's go to page 51, please. The first paragraph says, this world of ours has made more material progress in the last century than all the millenniums which went before. Almost everyone knows the reason. Students of ancient history tell us that the intellect of men in those days was equal to the best of today. Yet in ancient times, material progress was painfully slow. The spirit of modern scientific inquiry, research, and invention was almost unknown. You know, I used to wonder, why is it that we today have all these airplanes and cell phones and television? Are we as a race just smarter than they were 500 years ago? Well, the answer is no. They had the same capacity to learn as we did, which means intellect. The only thing that kept those people from learning anything different than what they knew was this. He said, in the realm of the material, men's minds were fettered by superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas.
Prejudice.
Superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas. Even right here in this part of our country, some 225 or 30 years ago, people came and developed this area, this whole area up here, for religious freedom. That's why they came over here, so they could practice their religion as they wanted to freely without any interference from anybody. And that was fine. And as long as you practice your religion somewhat like they did in this area, you notice all the different religions and different churches that we see through all these towns, as long as you practice your religion somewhat like they did, you were okay. But if you had an idea that was different from what they had and you expressed it, guess what they did for you? They burned you at the stake for being a witch. That's why they burn people up here for that. See, so superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas kept us in the Dark Ages a little longer. I think today that's one of the great things about America today is I think as a society our minds are open to almost anything now, almost. But the thing that kept me locked back in the original religion and beliefs of a seven-year-old boy was what? Superstition, tradition, and fixed ideas. That's why I need an open mind. I need an open mind more today than I've ever needed an open mind. And hopefully I can keep my mind open so that I can continue to learn.
He said some of the contemporaries of Columbus thought a round earth was preposterous. I think Columbus is one of the greatest examples of what we can do based upon belief. You know, 500 years ago, practically all of what they then thought was the civilized world was centered around the shores of the Mediterranean Sea, western shores of Europe. They had found a place called the East Indies. In the East Indies, you could get lots of gold, silk, and spices. The only problem with going to the East Indies, it took a long time to get there. The only way they had to go was to sail to the northeast end of the Mediterranean, and then they would go by land, camelback, horseback, footback, however they traveled. It took literally years to make the trip. And they were trying to find a new trade route to the East Indies so they could get there and they could get back faster. And somebody said, well, is there any possibility that we could sail a ship to the East Indies? And they said, well, no, dummy. Don't you know the only thing you can do is sail to the northeast end of the Mediterranean, and then you have to go by land? And they said, well, what would happen if we sailed the other way? And they said, well, dummy, don't you understand that the world is flat? And if you sail out there, you're going to sail right off the edge of this sucker. Now, I don't know why they believe that. I assume some people sailed out there and didn't come back. And they assumed they had sailed off the edge of it. So the whole world was stymied as far as trying to find the new trade route to the East Indies. Here comes Columbus. Now, we're convinced in our minds today that Columbus had to be an alcoholic. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You know, you got to be tough and stubborn and bullheaded to stand there and express a belief different from what everybody else in the world believes. Columbus said, I do not believe this thing is flat. I believe that it's round. And that's a wonder they didn't kill him right then, too. Also, he made some of the most drunk statements the world's ever heard. He said, I believe you can get you could get east by sailing west. Now, if that isn't drunk thinking, I don't know what is. Many of his mannerisms and the things that he did shows he's alcoholic. Because when he left, he didn't know where he was going. When he got there, he didn't know where he was. When he came back, he didn't even know where he had been. But what really made him an alcoholic is a woman financed the whole trip for him. Yeah.
She did that twice.
Did it twice. Yeah. He had to be alcoholic. Columbus used a little formula.
I'm going to write down these key words, this little formula.
Columbus used a little formula that the world has always known. That if you want to change anything, there are certain things you have to do in order to get the changes made. And the first thing you have to do is be willing to change. Circumstances are what makes people willing to change. Trying to find the new trade route to the East Indies is what made Columbus willing to change his belief. The second thing you have to do to change anything is to change what you believe. Columbus says, I believe the world is round. I don't believe it's flat. I believe you can get east by sailing west. But his belief didn't do him any good, because he's still standing on the shore of the ocean the day he expressed that belief. Some days, weeks, months, years later, Columbus did the third thing you have to do to change anything. He made a decision. He said, by golly, I'm going to go find out whether this thing is round or flat, whether you can really get east by sailing west. But his decision didn't do him any good either, because he's still standing on the shore of the ocean the day he expressed it. Some days, weeks, months, years later, Columbus began to do the fourth thing you have to do to change anything. He began to take some action to carry out his decision. First thing he did, he went to the King of Portugal to get the money. And the King of Portugal, being a very astute businessman, said, Columbus, there's no way I'm going to let you have this money. He said, you'll sail out there and sail right off the edge of this sucker and I'll lose it all. Bye-bye. No, no. That's why he ended up with the Queen of Spain. Sweet-talked her out of the money. On the promise that he would bring back gold, silk, spices, and all the goody-goodies. She let him have the money. He took the money and he purchased three ships. He put provisions in all three of those ships. He put crew members in all three of those ships. And they began to go east by sailing west. Day after day after day, sailing straight west. Now, we're not sure, but we imagine on the first trip, he probably hired a special sailor, put him on the bow of the lead ship at night with a lantern, whispered in his ear, and said, "I believe this thing is round, but if you see the edge of this damn thing, you holler so we can get turned around in time." After having sailed straight west day after day after day after day, they got results. You always get the results from the action that you take. They found land on the other side. Now, we know that he thought it was the East Indies. It wasn't. It was the West Indies. But he had proven to himself that the world is round. It's not flat. You will not sail off the edge of it. He turned around and he came right back to Europe. Went right back to the Queen of Spain. And she said, "Columbus, where's the gold, silk, and spices you promised you would bring me?" And he said, "Sweetheart, I didn't find any." But he said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. If you'll refinance me, I'll go back. And this time I'll find them." And she refinanced him. He got some more ships, more provisions, more crew members. He began to go east by sailing west with one big difference. The second trip, he didn't hire the special sailor. Put him on a bow of the lead ship at night with a lantern, because you see, this time he went back in faith. He went back in surety. He went back in knowledge. He started with belief on the first trip. The second trip, he went back in faith. Now, I'd like to sit here today and tell you that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are brand new, that the world has never seen anything like them before. But if I did, I'd tell you a lie, because they're based on identically the same set of principles that Columbus and any other human being have ever used to change anything. The first thing you and I have to do in order to recover from alcoholism is we got to be willing to change. That's step one. The second thing we have to do is to believe we can do so. That's step two. The third thing we have to do is make a decision about that. And that's step three. The fourth thing we have to do is take the action required in steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11 to carry out the decision we've made in step 3. Then as we take the actions, we will get results too. And our result will be in step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Same identical formula that the world has always used. Now, those of us that have taken the action, those of us that have had the spiritual experience or the spiritual awakening, we no longer believe that God will restore us to sanity. We know that He will, because He's done so. Now, those that have been restored to sanity can go back and help the next newcomer come to believe. They can decide. They can act with our help. They'll have a spiritual awakening. They'll know, and they can go help the next newcomer come to believe. And that's what AA is all about. There's really only one thing you and I can't do for the newcomer. We cannot make them willing to change. Willingness is a job that they have to work on themselves. Now, how does a newcomer become willing to change? Or how does an alcoholic become willing to change? Very simple. Drinking whiskey. When you drink enough of it, you're almost dead from it, you can't stand it any longer, then you become willing to change. You know, I heard, had a guy tell me, he said, "Man, I've been in AA 5 years, and I've been working on step one in AA for 5 years. And I said, "No, you haven't." I said, "Hell, you don't work on step one in AA. You work on step one out there. And if you're not willing to change, then we recommend you go back and drink some more whiskey until you become willing to change, and then we can help you with the rest of the program." Isn't that a simple little deal? God, I never dreamed it could possibly be this simple. To understand and know that the first thing I have to do is be willing to change, and that comes from drinking. The second thing I have to do is believe or be willing to believe. There's a power greater than I am that can restore me to sanity. Then I have to make the decision, and then I have to take the action, and then I'll get the results. So if I know I need the power, if I know how to start the finding of that power, if I know the procedure to follow to find that power, then I really just need to know one more thing. Where is that power? Where am I going to find this God that I've been trying to get a new understanding of? And I think we get here just as confused about where God is as we were ever confused about what God was. You know, as a kid growing up in church, I got a picture of God in my mind. Now, I don't know whether I saw it or dreamed it, but in my mind, God was a tall, elderly gentleman standing on a cloud up in the sky, long, flowing white robes on, long white hair, golden halo around his head, and sun rays shooting out of that halo. And Joe said, yeah, and a big stick in his right hand.
Looking and booking.
Now, I don't know whether I saw that or whether I dreamed it, but I think one of the reasons I got that idea about God is I noticed every time the minister talked about God, he always pointed up there, so I knew God had to be up there somewhere. But then what really confused me in church is I noticed every time the minister wanted to talk to God, he always looked down here. He'll point up there. Hell, no wonder we get confused as kids in church about where God is and what God is. I looked and I looked and I looked and I looked and I never could find God. And one of the reasons I never could find him is I simply didn't know where he is. I never knew where God dwelt until I came to page 55 in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And it tells me exactly where I'm going to find him.
I was working with this young fellow in the treatment center one time, or halfway house, and asked me to be his sponsor. And he said, what do you think I should do? I said, well, I think it'd be a good idea. You got a job, got out of here to start with. He said, well, easy for you to say. I don't have any wheels. I can't get a job without a car. I said, well, I'll take you in my car and help you find a job and take you back and forth. You get a couple of paychecks. And we'll go on with this thing. He said, fine. So one morning on the way, he got a job. One morning on the way to work, he told me a little story that helped me. See, I'm always thinking I'm helping him, but he's going to help me now. He tells me the story, and it went like this. He said, there was these three wise men of the East. And he said, they stole from man the crown of life, the thing that would make us the happiest. And once they took it away from us, he said, now what are we going to do with it? And one of them said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll take it to the highest, highest crevice in the highest mountain in the world and hide it up there. They'll never be able to find it there. The other two said, yeah, but you know how they are. They'll hunt, they'll search, and they'll eventually find it. One of them said, well, we'll take it to the deepest, deepest ocean and the deepest crevice in the ocean, and we'll hide it there. They'll never be able to find it there. And the other two said, yeah, but you know how they are. They'll hunt, and they'll search, and they'll eventually find it. The third one said, I'll tell you what we do. Let's hide it within him, and he'll never think about looking for it there.
And page 55, yeah. First paragraph.
He said, yeah, we've been seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world, people who rose above their problems. They said God made these things possible, and we only smiled. We had seen spiritual release, but liked to tell ourselves it wasn't true. Actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it's there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. See, we're just born with it. Been there all along. We finally saw that faith in some kind of a God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. And the last analysis only there that it may be found, and it was so with us.
You know, we believe today that it seems as though every human being on earth seems to be born with some form of basic knowledge, probably lying within themselves at a subconscious level. And that basic knowledge seems to be able to tell us how we should live and how we shouldn't live. Seems to be able to tell us what we should do and what we shouldn't do. Now, I'm pretty sure a lot of people would like to refer to that as just plain old common sense. I think others might want to call it such things as innate intelligence. Some might want to call it the conscience, and others might refer to it as the soul. I don't think it really makes any difference what we call it, as long as we recognize the fact that it's there. And it's been there in my life as far back as I can remember. I used to be getting ready to do something, and some voice from within me would say, "Charlie, I really don't think you ought to be doing this." And I wouldn't pay a bit of attention to it. I'd go right ahead and do it and just get in one hell of a mess. And that same little voice would say, "See, I told you not to do it in the first place." Now, if that's true, and if that voice is the God that dwells with each of us, then what that really means to me today, that if God dwells within me, then I've got my own personal God. You see, I don't worry anymore about whether he's the God of the Baptist Church or not. I don't worry about whether he's God of the Catholic Church, the Hebrew religion, or anybody else's religion. If he dwells within me, he's my God. And he and I can come together in very simple, very understandable terms. Do you think I'm ready to make a decision now? You see, prior to this chapter, he was hellfire and damnation. Prior to this chapter, he wasn't going to do anything good for me. It was all going to be bad. But through discarding a few old ideas, picking up a few new ideas, then I've come to terms with this God thing. And now then I can make a decision about God. Thank God for this chapter. It's opened the door for millions of we alcoholics simply by letting us discard old ideas, pick up new ideas, make a decision, and then God is going to prove to us that there really is a kind and a loving God.
This next little paragraph is going to sum up this whole chapter in these next few little lines. It tells us what this chapter is all about. So we can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, which is old ideas, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. Now, with this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. So you will have a God of your own understanding as a result of the information in this chapter, we agnostics, and no one can improve upon it.
Okay, we can again see Bill as he finishes up with chapter 4, reviewing what he's done up to this point. Probably able to say to himself, I was able to show them the problem, and the doctor's opinion and my story, Bill's story. I was able to show them the solution in chapter 2. I was able to show them what's going to happen to them if they don't find that solution in chapter 3. I was able to give them some new ideas about that solution in chapter 4 so they could make a decision. And I think he says to himself now, that's all the preliminary work. What we really need to do now is get on with the main object of the book and start telling them how to find the power greater than human power. And he sits down and he begins to try to write on chapter 5. And he always said he had a terrible, terrible time even getting started in chapter 5. They had 6 little steps that they had made from the Oxford Group tenets. And Bill said these steps had loopholes in them where the alcoholic mind was slipping through them. And he said, I knew they needed to be expanded, but I didn't know how far. He said, I knew they had to have more strength for alcoholics than they did for usual normal people, but he didn't know how far they needed to be expanded. Also, this God thing was a terrible problem in AA for a long time. In Akron, Ohio, God wasn't any problem there. Dr. Bob was a highly religious man. He used the Bible, and he insisted everybody he worked with use the Bible. And God wasn't a bad word in Akron. But now this New York City bunch down here, they were an entirely different breed of cats. They didn't want any part of this God thing. They wanted to keep this, as much as they could, a program and a book dealing with the mind itself, and keep all this other stuff out of there as much as you can. And there was a constant fight going on as to how much God do we want in here, how much God do we not want in here, so on and so forth. The original people in AA were Protestant people. We found, though, later on, not too long after that, Catholic people started coming into AA. It wasn't very long that a sprinkling of Jewish people started coming into AA. Next thing you knew, two or three Muslims began to show up in AA. Now, Bill's getting ready to write a set of directions on how to find God to all these different people. And how in the hell are you going to talk about God without alienating somebody? And he said, I tried and I tried and I tried and I tried, and I just could not get started on chapter 5. And he said, one night in bed, pillow behind his back, leaning against the headboard, pad and pencil in hand, trying to start chapter 5, he said, I finally just gave up. And said, I put the pad and the pencil down, closed my eyes, prayed, and asked God for help and asked God for direction. Said, I meditated on this for maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And he said, I then reached out and picked up the pad and pencil, and it felt as if the pencil had a mind of its own as it raced across the pages. In about 20 minutes, Bill wrote how it works. That thing that we read today at practically all of our AA meetings. But the thing he wrote that night is not exactly like it is in your book today. Because when the other members saw what he had written that night and how it works, many of them objected to it quite strenuously. And the fight was on, and they fought and they fought, and they almost destroyed not only the book project, but the entire little fellowship over the original writing of how it works. Now, Joe's going to read the original how it works to you. And I think he'll try, by changing the tone of his voice, pausing or something, to point out the differences between what's in the book today and what Bill wrote that night. If you go through it with him, I think you can see why they objected to some of these things, and I think you can see what Bill really, really had in mind the night he wrote how it works, Joe.
Works the original manuscript. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclosed in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to follow directions. At some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that you are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as your program of recovery. 1. Admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood him.
Over to the care and direction of God as we understood him. Remember that. We'll refer to it later on.
4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. We're entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly, on our knees, asking to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual experience as a result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Now you may exclaim, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic.
This is the doctor's opinion. Some of it in Bill's story. Some of it in chapter 2 and 3. But most of it in the doctor's opinion.
But chapter 2, the agnostic.
Chapter 4.
And our personal adventures before and after.
Bill's story and those in the back of the book.
Have been designed to sell you 3 pertinent ideas. Well, Bill was a salesman, you know. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life.
Step 1.
B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism.
Step 2.
C, that God can and will.
The rest of step 2.
Now, if you're not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away.
What could be more clear? You know, there's just no doubt that Bill did not intend for this to be a set of suggestions. He intended for it to be a set of directions to the individual alcoholic on how to recover from alcoholism. And that's when the crab hit the fan. The other members saw that. And they said, "Bill, you don't have any business trying to give anybody directions. Period." They said, "Also, Bill, some of these terms that you're using in here, like humbly on our knees, complete amends, entirely willing," they said, "those things sound too much like the Oxford Group absolutes. We don't want those kind of things in there. And you're going to have to change some of this stuff." And Bill said, "Well, no, I'm not going to change this." He said, "You know, I think this is what it really ought to be, the way we have it worded now." And they said, "Yeah, but Bill, don't you remember? This is not your book, it's our book. And you're going to have to change it the way we want it done." Bill said, "No, I don't intend to do that." And they said, "Yes, you are." And he said, "No, I'm not." And they said, "Yeah, you are." And the fight was on. Finally, one day, Bill said to him, "You guys don't realize that these are not even my words." He said, "These are God's words. They came after prayer and meditation." And they said, "We don't give a damn whose words they are. It's our book, and you're going to change it." And they fought, and they fought, and they fought, and they fought. And they really did almost destroy not only the book project, but the entire little fellowship at that time. And sooner or later, Bill very reluctantly recognized the fact that he was going to have to compromise if they were going to get any further with this book project. And at the suggestion of a non-alcoholic psychiatrist, they made a few changes. The psychiatrist said, "Why don't you change it from directions to suggestions?" He said, "You'll still get your idea across, and you probably won't alienate so many people." And he said, "Where you keep saying you, you, you," he said, "don't do that." He said, "Say we. Say this is what we had to do rather than what you have to do. And probably you won't alienate so many people." And he said, "Where you keep saying must, change that to ought. And he said, "I believe if you'll make these changes, more people would probably accept this book. Today we don't know. You know, if they hadn't made the changes, if they'd left it like it was, maybe instead of 2 million worldwide today, we'd have 10 million. Also, if they hadn't made the changes, instead of 2 million worldwide, maybe we'd only have 10,000. We don't know. Nobody knows. We just know this is the history behind this particular part of the book." But now Bill was cunning, baffling, and powerful too. Because he said to them, "Okay, I'm going to compromise with you. And I'm going to make the changes you want. But you're going to have to compromise with me." And they said, "Well, what do you want?" He said, "I'm tired." He said, "I've argued with you all the way through these chapters up to chapter 5. And said, now then, it's just almost destroyed the whole thing." And he said, "I don't intend to go through this anymore." He said, "If you want me to finish the book, you give me the authority to do so. And if you don't want to give me the authority to do so, then you finish the book." Well, they didn't want to give him that authority, but they didn't want to have to finish the book either. They very reluctantly agreed to that. Now, what Bill knew that they didn't know is 2 pages later, he's going to put directions and you and must right back in the book. You see, he's had it in the book all the way up to chapter 5. They jerked it out of the reading of how it works. He turns right around and sticks it right back in, and it destroyed some of the continuity of the book. But now that we see what took place, we can see what actually happened. We can see what Bill really, really intended for this to be. The other thing that is so obvious, when he talks about these 3 pertinent ideas, and he talked about where we found those 3 pertinent ideas, then it's obvious that the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters are designed to give us the information necessary to be able to accept steps 1 and 2 in our lives. Well, people come to us today and they say, "How do you work steps 1 and 2? And we say, "You don't. They are not working steps. They are not action steps. They are conclusions of the mind that we draw based upon information presented to us in the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters. I've always been powerless over alcohol. My life's always been unmanageable because of that. I just did not know that, nor did I know why, until I read the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters. There's always been a power greater than I am could restore me to sanity. I just did not believe that power would do so, nor did I understand the insanity I had to be restored from until I read the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters." Now, if I can say to myself today, "You betcha, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life has become unmanageable." If I can say to myself today, "You betcha, I believe there's a power greater than I am can restore me to sanity," then I'm through with steps 1 and steps 2. And it's not by accident. The very next statement in the book says, "Being convinced, we're now at step 3. You see, chapter 5 starts with step 3. That's why you can't start with chapter 5. You got to have the doctor's opinion and the first 4 chapters and the first 2 steps behind you before you can begin to make the decision that's called for in step three, Joe?
It says being convinced we were at step three. We're not ready to take step three yet. We're just at step three after one and two, which is we decided to turn our will and our life over to God's be understood. Well, just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? Very good question, I would say. Well, we're going to make a decision to turn our will. And what is our will? Our will is our thinking. The main problem of the alcoholic is in the mind. We're going to make a decision to turn our will or our thinking over to the care and direction of God as we understood Him. Turn our will and our life, and our life is our actions. So we're simply going to make a decision to turn our will, our thinking, our life, our actions over to the care and direction of God as we understood Him. That's what we're getting ready to do. We haven't gotten there yet, but that's what we're going to do. We're going to make a decision to do that.
You know, once again, this whole thing is tied up in the understanding of the words that are used. And there's three words in step three that seem to have given a lot of us difficulty in the past, a lot of us difficulty today. Quite often I hear people say, well, I've been in AA about 5 years. My life's still all screwed up. And I don't understand why, because I turned it over to God 4 years ago when I took step three. No, we don't turn anything over to God in step three. We make a decision to turn something over to God in step three. The decision itself implies there's going to have to be some further action taken in order to carry this thing out. A good example in my own life, a few years ago, my wife Barbara and I decided to go to Los Angeles, California, and visit our relatives. But we didn't do anything to carry that decision out. And sure enough, we didn't get to Los Angeles either. The second year in a row, we made the same decision to go visit our relatives, but again, we didn't do anything to carry it out. And the second year in a row, we didn't get to Los Angeles. The third year in a row, we made the same decision. Only this time, it was a little different. This time I took the car down and had it serviced. Barbara packed the clothes and a little food. And we got in our car and we drove from our home to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Then we drove to Oklahoma City. Then we drove to Amarillo, Texas. Then we drove to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Then we drove to Flagstaff, Arizona. Then we drove to Barstow, California. Then we drove to San Bernardino, California. And then we drove to Los Angeles. And you know, one day we ended up in our relatives' living room visiting with them. Not because we made a decision, but because we took the action necessary to carry out that decision. And we're going to find that steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11 are all action steps designed to carry out the decision that we're making in step 3. So all we're doing in three is deciding. We're not turning anything over. We're simply deciding to. What is it we're deciding to turn over? Well, we made a decision to turn our will over to the care and direction of God as we understood Him. Now, what is our will? Well, our will is nothing more than our thinking apparatus. Our will is nothing more than our mind. Our will is nothing more than this thing up here in our head that tells us what to do and what not to do. And by the way, as far as we know, we're the only species on earth that's ever faced with this decision. It seems as though all the other species on earth, they don't have this thing called self-will. Everything they do is on God's time, at God's direction. It seems as though we human beings are the only species that He has given this thing called self-will. And He allows us to operate on any given time on self-will or on God's will. And that's the only two wills here on earth. You know, you walk outside this door and look outside, and you see the beautiful trees, the beautiful flowers, the green grass, the birds. Those are all God's will. done on God's time at God's direction. Everything else you see out there, like the buildings and the telephone poles and the automobiles, they're all examples of human will. And there's only two of them on earth, God's will or human will. So we're making a decision to turn our thinking apparatus over to the care and direction of God as we understand Him. A good example of tying the will and the thinking together. Let's say that some of us are beginning to approach the end of our lives, and a few of us in here are beginning to get along in years. We've gathered up a few material things, and we become concerned with what's going to happen to those things after we leave here. If we get concerned enough, we'll go down and sit down with an attorney, and we'll tell that attorney what we want done with these things. I want this to go to my spouse, and this is to be my daughters, and I want this to go to my son, etc., etc., etc. That attorney will take my thinking coming from my mind that day, write it down on a piece of paper in legal terms. I'll sign it. Maybe the attorney will sign it as a witness, and we'll put it in the safe, and I'll leave the office. Now, sure enough, 2, 3, 4 years later, I kick the bucket. And my family's like the rest of them. They're going to call that undertaker and say, come get him. Let's get him out of here about as fast as we can. Let's get him out to that cemetery, and let's do away with him right now. You know, used to they waited a week to do that. Hell, now they do it just within a day or two. Don't wait any time at all. The attorney gets me ready, and they all get out to that cemetery. And they've got me suspended in a long box over a big hole in the ground. And a few people standing around that box, and maybe some of them are got a tear or two in their eyes. I doubt it. They're probably all clapping with glee. But maybe one or two of them will say a prayer, and I hope it'll be an AA member that does so. They get through those little services, and they start dropping that box in the hole. Now, if my family's like the rest of them, I've noticed the last few years, they don't even wait till the box gets to the bottom of the hole. Just as soon as it starts down, they jump in the car, and they head for that attorney's office. And that attorney gets out that piece of paper and reads to them what my thinking was 2 or 3 years prior to that time when I'm sitting there in that office. We know they call that piece of paper a will. It's not by accident. Will, thinking, mind are all synonymous. So I'm making a decision to turn my thinking apparatus over to the care and direction of God as I understand it. What else am I deciding to turn over? Not only am I making a decision to turn my will, but I'm making a decision to turn my life over to the care and direction of God as I understand it. What is my life? My life is nothing more than my actions. What I am today, right now, as of this moment, sitting behind this table, is the sum accumulative total of all the actions I've taken throughout my entire lifetime has made me just exactly what I am right now. Now, all action is born in thought.
Could you say that again, please?
All action is born in thought. It's not by accident the step says will and life. A lot of people read that backwards and say life and will. No, that's backwards. It is will and life. So, if my life is nothing more than my actions, and if my actions are controlled by the way I think, then it stands to reason what I am today is based upon how I think. If my thinking is okay, then chances are my actions are going to be okay. And chances are my life's going to be all right too. If my thinking is lousy, then chances are my actions are going to be lousy. And chances are my life's going to be lousy too. When I got to step three, I went to my sponsor and I said, I don't believe I can take step three. And he said, why? I said, because if I turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand it, I have no idea what He would have me be. And He may want me to be a missionary. And He may want to send me to China. And I sure as hell don't want to go there. And he just laughed. And he said, well, at least it wouldn't be in the hands of an idiot, would it? He said, Charlie, let's look back in your lifetime. He said, you've always been a selfish, self-centered, self-willed human being. You've always done what you wanted to do whenever you wanted to do it, and the hell with the rest of them. Is that right? And I said, well, you know it is. He said, the end result of that kind of thinking is that you've taken the actions that almost destroyed your life. And he said, just as importantly, you've almost destroyed the lives of those around you that care for you. He said, just think, if God could direct your thinking, it might become better. And he said, if your thinking becomes better, your actions are going to become better. And he said, if your actions become better, your life's going to become better. And he said, just as importantly, the lives of those around you that care for you would probably become better too. He said, Charlie, you're trying to find a way to live where not only can you be sober, but you can be sober and peaceful and happy and free. And he said, left on self-will, you don't stand a chance. He said, you'll keep thinking the way you've always thought. You'll keep doing the same old things you've always done. You'll remain restless, irritable, and discontented. You'll remain filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. And he said, sooner or later, under those conditions, you're going to start thinking about taking a drink in order to feel better. And the next thing you know, you're going to end up drunk all over again. Step back about 3 feet. Stuck his bony old finger right in the middle of my chest. And he said, now you have to make the decision. He said, I wish I could make it for you, but I can't. You'll have to do this one. And he got it through to me in such a manner that I understood why it's necessary for me to make this decision in step 3. And he made clear that I understood that it's only a decision. We don't really get anything done here. We just make the decision, Joe.
And the book goes on to say that the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. You know, we said all along that the book talks about precisely, specifically, the clear-cut directions. Bill's going to start some of those clear-cut directions here now for us. And he says the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the valet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including yourself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. You know, wouldn't it be nice if everybody would just mind? If everybody would do as I wish, the show would be great. Everything would be wonderful. That's why this program don't work, by the way. He told us how it works. Now he's telling us why it won't work. It's because we're always trying to arrange the life of other people, constantly in conflict with them and other people, always. So the program won't work under those conditions. But I still sometimes think, if only people would do as I wish, it would be wonderful. But they don't do it. You know, God gave us all a self-will. That's the problem with it. Everybody's got one. My wife's will for her is one thing, and my will for her is another. And it sometimes is in conflict. See, if only she would do as I wished, the show would be great. But she just won't mind. You know, some 12 or 13 years after Bill wrote the big book, he had lots of counsel with lots of learned people around the world, and he worked with an awful lot of drunks by this time. He gained an awful lot of experience working with drunks and being informed by other people about people. And after the 12 or 13 years, he decided to give us some more information about the steps. And he wrote down a little book called The 12, The 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions. He primarily was interested in carrying the traditions to us. He was doing that quite a bit then. So he thought, well, if I put some information about the steps in front of it, people would buy it better and they would learn the tradition. But in the 12 and 12, Bill wrote down some of the best information that I have ever learned. In the 12 and 12, in the area of the fourth step, he talks about the basic instincts of life, and he goes through them on the first three or four pages of the 12 and 12. Valuable information. And I think that information that he wrote down in the 12 and 12 is extremely important. That's one reason why people don't do the inventory process on page 65 of this book, because they don't quite understand what Bill meant in that third column. So that information is extremely important. So today when I sponsor somebody, I ask them to go to the 12 and 12 and to read that information about the basic instincts of life, get a working knowledge of those words so they can get an understanding of what he wants you to write down in column 3 of the inventory process.
You know, I think we have to face the fact that when Bill wrote the big book in 1938 and 39, Bill was not a great spiritual giant. Bill was not a great student of human nature. Bill was a night school lawyer. He studied economics and business as well as law. Yet he was able to write one of the most spiritual books dealing with human nature that the world's ever seen. Surely, surely God had a hand in this. And he simply used Bill to write the book. And Bill did the absolute best he could do when he wrote the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. 13 years later, after having worked with some of the greatest minds in the world regarding spirituality and human nature, Bill knew a lot more about what he was talking about. And I think he felt he had some additional information that he could give to us that would enable us to work the steps better according to the big book Alcoholics Anonymous if we knew this information. And we find that in the 12 and 12, you really can't work the steps out of the 12 and 12. There's no directions in the 12 and 12 that tells you how to work them. That's why a lot of people love it. They can get in it and dance around and philosophize and never have to do anything, period. The big book pins you down and tells you what you have to do. But there's some information in the 12 and 12 that I think it's invaluable information that if we know it and understand it and can accept it, it makes it so much easier to understand the steps and work them according to the big book, especially in the area of step 3 and step 4. There in the 12 and 12, in the first three or four pages on step 4, he talks about the three basic instincts of life that are God-given, that are absolutely necessary for survival of the human race. Let's look at them for just a few minutes, just to get a little idea. And I think by seeing these, then we can really understand why we need to make this decision. Plus, it sets us up for the information we're going to need for step 4. Bill said all human beings are born with these three basic instincts of life. They're necessary for survival of the human race. They are God-given. Therefore, they are good things. And the first thing he talks about is the social instinct. To be liked, to be accepted, to be respected by other people. He said all human beings are born with a desire to come together in groups with other people. He said if we didn't have these desires, if we cared nothing about each other, that the world would go into a dog-eat-dog situation, complete anarchy would reign, and under those conditions, sooner or later, the human race would simply fail to survive. So these desires that you and I have to be liked, to be accepted, to be respected, to be in the company of a fellow man, they are good, God-given, therefore they are good things. He uses several terms under the social instinct. One term he uses, wanting to be a part of, knew we could not be. Always afraid that whatever we said, whatever we did would be the wrong thing. People would laugh at us and we would be rejected. He uses the term prestige. Prestige is wanting to be recognized, to be accepted as the leader of the group. And the world needs leaders. Somebody's got to be a decision maker. I guess even in the old caveman days, somebody had to say, Jeffrey, get behind that tree with your club. John, get behind that bush with your spear. And Billy Jack and I'll run this sucker through here. And somebody had to do that. And most people will take one of two directions. Either let me be a part of, or let me be the leader of. In either case, it's going to depend upon what other people think of us. If they like us and accept us, great. He talks about self-esteem. Self-esteem is nothing more than what we think of ourselves, high or low. And what we think of ourselves is usually based upon what other people think of us or what we think other people think of us. If they seem to like us and accept us, then we feel pretty good toward ourselves. But if they seem to reject us, then we feel pretty lousy toward ourselves. He uses the term pride. And I'm glad I got in the habit of going to the dictionary. I always thought pride is something you ought to have. As a young boy growing up, all I ever wanted to be was a man who walked tall with pride and a little bit sideways like John Wayne did. That's all I ever wanted to be. But I find out that pride is an excessive and unjustified opinion of oneself. We either think too highly of ourselves or too low. In either case, it's usually not the truth. Personal relationships is our relations with other human beings and the world around us. Ambitions are our plans to gain acceptance, power, recognition, prestige, and etc., our plans for the future. All of these things are part of the human nature. Now, if you and I want to be liked and accepted and respected by the world and the people in it, then the first thing we have to do is decide, well, what is it they want from us? And society teaches us these things as we grow up. You know, in one part of the world, perhaps it's to have a good education. Another part of the world, perhaps, is to be a large landowner. Another part of the world, maybe, is to have a large family. It can be any number of things, and it'll vary in different parts of the world. Based upon what we're taught, based upon what we see, what we observe as we grow up, then we make a determination as to what we want to be. We're like the actor that wants to run the whole show. We begin to write in our head the script of what we're going to be. Now, if we're going to be liked and accepted and respected, we're going to have to set these goals for ourselves. And if we're going to reach the goal, we're going to have to work at it. You know, if it's a good education, if it's a good land over, whatever it is, we're going to have to work toward that. And by the same token, not only are we going to have to work toward that, we're also going to have to make some sacrifices. There are some things that I would like to do as a human being that are very enjoyable and very pleasurable. But if I do them and you catch me at it, you're not going to like me at all. And I don't think you and I would do the work necessary to reach the goal, nor make the sacrifices necessary to be acceptable, unless we get a reward for doing so. And the great reward comes at the moment of successful completion of the goal. Bill said it in his story when he said, I had arrived. My God, how many of us have done it? We've set that goal, and we just literally worked our tails off for years to get there. And the day we get there, and they pat us on the back, and they say, ah, Joe, you're a fine fella. You're a smart man. You're really doing great. One of those feelings come over us, which is one of those indescribably wonderful feelings when we get the praise and the recognition. The only thing wrong with it, though, it seems to be just a temporary feeling. Hell, we no sooner get the praise, the recognition, than we look around and we say, well, is this all there is to it? And we set another goal. And we work and we work and we strive and we strive and we reach the new goal. We get the praise, the recognition, it feels good, doesn't last long, and we set another goal. And it seems to create within we human beings an insatiable desire for more and more power, more and more recognition, more and more acceptance. And we're not getting it fast enough. They're not giving it to us the way we think they ought to. So what do we do about that? Well, we start taking shortcuts. we start doing a little lying, a little conning, a little manipulating, a little stepping on other people's toes and climbing on their backs, and the instant we do so, we create pain and suffering for others. They, in turn, retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. Plain little life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success. Under those conditions, we will always be in collision with people, places, and things. The second basic instinct he talked about is the security instinct. Now, I know in AA we try to live one day at a time, but I also know nearly everybody in this room's got an insurance policy. And the purpose of the insurance policy is to protect ourselves in the future. Bill said all human beings are born with a desire to be secure in the future. He said if we were not concerned with those things, we wouldn't provide the food, the clothing, the shelter, the things that we need in the future. And under those conditions, sooner or later, the human race would fail to survive. So once again, if I'm going to be secure in the future, I've got to decide, well, what is it I need to be secure? This is going to vary in different parts of the world. One part of the world, I may just need $4. Another part of the world, I may need $4,000. Another part of the world, I may need $4 billion. Based upon what part of the world I'm living in as to what I need to be secure. Now, based upon what I think I'm going to need, then I, once again, set goals for myself. And I begin to work toward that goal. Maybe it's to secure a new business. Maybe it's to secure a new home. Maybe it's to secure this, that, or whatever it might be. And if I'm going to be secure in the future, I'm going to have to work at it. I can't be a bum and sit on my duff and be secure in the future. By the same token, I'm going to have to make some sacrifices. Can't blow it all today and be secure tomorrow. And once again, the great reward comes at the moment of successful completion of the goal. How many of us have done it? We set the goal for the new bicycle. We set the goal for the new dress. We set the goal for the new suit. We set the goal for the new car, for the new home, for the new business. And we work and we work and we strive and we strive. And the day that sucker's paid off, nobody can take it away from us. My God, what a great feeling that is. Hell, when I was a kid growing up, hardly anybody owned their own homes. Nearly everybody rented. And once in a while, somebody would get enough money together to make a down payment on a little old house somewhere, and they would literally pay all that sucker for years, and the day they got it paid off, my God, what a celebration. They called in the neighbors, and they had a party, and they celebrated by burning the mortgage. It was such a great thing. The only thing wrong with it, though, is just a temporary feeling. Hell, no sooner do I get that house paid for than I look around, and her house is bigger than mine. Yeah. This guy here, he's driving a Cadillac, and I'm still driving a Chevrolet. Jeffrey here, he's got a Brooks Brothers suit, and I bought mine at K-Market. And that caused us to set another goal. And we work and we work, and we strive and we strive, and we reach the new goal. Doesn't last very long, and we set a new goal. It seems to create within we human beings an insatiable desire for more and more and more and more and more and more. We're not getting it fast enough. They're not giving it to us the way we think they should, so what do? Well, we take shortcuts. We lie. We cheat. We con. We manipulate. We steal if necessary. The instant we do so, we create pain and suffering for others. They, in turn, retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. Plain little life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success because we're always in collision with people, places, and things. Third basic instinct he talks about is the sex instinct.
Better have a sip of coffee.
I better have a sip of coffee before we get on sex. Bill says all human beings are born with a desire to have sex.
He gets excited about this.
He said, now, it may get turned off by bad teachings or bad happenings, but he said all human beings are born with a desire to have sex because if we don't have sex, we can't reproduce ourselves. And if we don't reproduce ourselves, then sure enough, the human race is going to fail to survive. Now, just like the other two, if you're going to reproduce yourself through the sexual act, you're going to have to work at it. Hell, you can do more work in 3 minutes of sex. If you can last that long, then you'll do all day digging a ditch. Don't you older fellas remember how it used to be when we got through with it? My God, you just fall over sideways, the sweat's just poured off of you. You can hardly get your breath. You feel like you've died, gone to heaven, come back two or three times. And I don't think you and I would do that kind of work if we didn't get a reward for doing so. And the great reward we get is that great feeling, both physically and emotionally, at the moment of successful completion of the sex act. One of the greatest feelings a human being can experience. But also, just like the other two, it seems to be just a temporary feeling. Hell, you no sooner get through with doing it than you get to thinking about doing it again. And it's such an exciting and such a pleasurable thing that the next thing you know, we get to thinking about doing it in different ways, and we get to thinking about doing it in different positions, and we get to thinking about doing it with different people, and the next thing you know, we're doing it at the wrong time, in the wrong way, with the wrong people, and the instant we do so, we create pain and suffering for others. They in turn retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. Plain little life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success, because under those conditions we're always in collision with people, places, and things. Bill said that if every human being could fulfill these three basic instincts at the level that God intended, there would be no conflict on earth today. But he also says all emotional human problems stem from one of these three things. He said they are such a pleasurable thing that left on self-will, we simply could not keep from overdoing in those areas. And that creates problems with others and blocks us off from any possibility of peace of mind, serenity, and happiness. You'll notice coming out of those three basic instincts a little circle called self. Those three basic instincts are what create self-will. Trying to fulfill those instincts are what creates our problems for us. Coming out of that circle, there's another one called wrongs. It's another word you got to look at. Somewhere in AA, we got the idea that the word wrongs means a list of dirty, filthy, nasty things. But you go to the dictionary and look it up, and you'll find several definitions for it. One definition of the word wrong is incorrect judgment of others. And a little later on, we're going to find out that's exactly what a resentment is. Another definition of the word wrong is incorrect believing. A little later on, we're going to find out that's what most of our fears are. Another definition of the word wrong are the harms and hurts that we do to other people. And we harm and hurt those other people. If God dwells within us, we know the difference between right and wrong, and guilt and remorse begins to eat us up based on the things that we do to hurt others. It's very easy to spot a selfish, self-centered human being. They will always display three common manifestations of self. They're always madder than hell. Damn him and damn her, and by God, I'll show them. They're not going to treat me that way. And blah-dee, blah-dee, blah-blah, 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 blah. Selfish, self-centered human being is always scared to death. Can't depend on God. Can't depend on other human beings. And if we're an alcoholic reaching the end of the road, we can't depend on ourselves any longer. And we're running absolutely scared to death. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but we know when it gets here, it's not going to be worth a damn, whatever it is. Selfish, self-centered human being, in fulfilling the three basic instincts of life, is always overdoing, hurting other people, scared to death what they're going to do when they catch us, and the guilt and the remorse associated with those things literally eat us up. A mind that is filled with resentments, a mind that is filled with fear, a mind that is filled with guilt and remorse does not feel good. And we alcoholics will run around under those conditions just so long, and the mind starts seeking relief, and it starts thinking about the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks, Now, next thing you know, we've convinced ourselves it's okay to drink, and we end up drunk all over again. This is why we got to do something about self-will. If we don't do something about self-will, we simply do not stand the chance of the peace of mind, serenity, and happiness necessary for long-term sobriety.
We'll take a break pretty soon, so bear with us here. Go to page 62, if you will. It said, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. We're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly but without provocation. But we invariably find that sometime in the past we've made decisions based on self, which later put us in a position to be hurt. I'll read that again. But we invariably find that sometime in the past we have made decisions based on the satisfaction of those basic instincts of life, which later put us in a position to be hurt. You know, I don't know about you, but if you don't have God in your life like I didn't, there's only one thing left for a reason for living, and that's to satisfy your basic instincts in life. I wanted more respect. I wanted more property. I wanted more prestige. I wanted more money. I wanted more sex. I wanted what I wanted because I didn't have God in my life, and I needed to satisfy those basic instincts of life, and I overused those basic instincts of life. He said, so our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. And God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us have had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would like to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. We can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. We've got to have God's help. Well, this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work.
You know, this is a God-directed world, and everything I read leads me to believe that's so. And those of us who have been self-directed, and those of us who've been trying to direct everything and everybody around us, we've been trying to do God's work for him. And we're not God. We've just been playing at being God. And the book says we're going to have to quit playing at being God, period.
He said next. He tells us what to do next. Next, we decided hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director.
Not our suggester. Our director. He's got his word right back in now.
Yeah.
From now on, it'll be director and directions.
Well, he is the principal, and we are his agents. He is the father, and we're his children. Most good ideas are simple. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed the freedom. See, I almost missed that. See, I used to ask God to help me get my wife back, and God, would you please help me get a better job than I have and help me make more money? God, would you pick me up a new car while you're out there doing all that? See, I use God. And by the way, if there's something I forgot to ask you for, would you give me that also? You know, I was using God like he were an errand boy, you see. I didn't know that he's the principal and we're the agents. After I got sober, I got to reading another big, big book. And it says in there that he worked for 6 days and then he rested. Now, to my knowledge, he didn't have to go back to work anymore. It looks to me like there's going to be work being done around here. It's going to be me. You see, he's the principal. We're the agent. He's the father. We're the children. He's the boss. I work for him. Most good ideas are simple. And this was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch which we were passed to freedom.
Now then, we're beginning to talk again about that wonderfully effective spiritual structure. Step one, willingness, was the foundation. Step two, believing, was the cornerstone. And step three, he tells us we're building an arch, and we're going to pass through it to freedom. And the keystone in the arch, the stone in the top that holds the arch and supports it, is the simple little idea that we're going to let God be the director. He's the boss. We're the employee. He is the father. We are the children. This concept, such a simple little idea, but so alien to our nature. We've always been self-directed people. So So now then we're making a decision to change that and let God be the director. And it'll be the keystone of the arch we're going to build. If we don't do it, the arch is going to fall in. If we do it and put the stone in place properly, then that's going to support the arch. We're in the process of having the spiritual experience, the spiritual awakening, as we progress through the steps. This is the keystone of that arch.
Said, now, when we sincerely took such a position, the one just described, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. See, I'm supposed to perform his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. See, you know, takers are losers. Takers in life are losers. So I was always a taker. Now I'm trying to see what I can contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of His presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. Boy, I used to hate that idea about being reborn. Guys used to come up to my house in that little church up the road from where I used to live and come on and knock on my door Monday night, and they want to talk to me about being reborn. I'm sitting there and telling them, I said, man, this is Monday night football. I'm drinking and having a good time, and I really don't want you guys here, and I don't hear a damn thing you got to say. So get on back down the road. That's the way I treated people like that. You know, I was real smart. And after I got sober, I got to reading again that little in that other book, and I got to reading another story. This guy's name was Nicodemus. He was dumb as I was. And dumb as a stump, as I like to put it. And he went to this guy who was talking about being reborn. He asked him, he said, what do you mean when you talk about being reborn? You mean I've got to go back into my mother's womb? And he said, looked at him, he said, man, did you go to the university? Aren't you educated? Don't you know you can't do that? When I'm talking to you about being reborn, I'm talking about the renewing of your mind. Old ideas cast aside, new ones accepted. To be reborn in your mind, not in your body. I could buy that. Now I could see what they meant. And it says, we were now at step three, once I understood that. And I'll never forget when I got ready to do step three. That little church down there, they had a little thing that they would do on Sunday morning about 11 o'clock. I suppose in the morning about 11 o'clock they'll be doing it again. They basically ask people to come there and to do the third step prayer. What they mean for this to
We do. Call it altar call in the Baptist church. Yeah.
They've got this long bench they got there. I'm not quite sure what all that. But anyhow, I was ready to do step three. I wanted to do step three officially. And so the next Sunday morning, about 11 o'clock, I got there about 2 or 3 minutes before 11. I don't get there too early. I might hear something that would help me. You see. So I got there just about 11 o'clock, and sure enough, they asked people to come down and do the third step prayer. And so I went down there as sincerely and as honestly and as humbly as I knew how, and this is what I did. I said, God, I offer myself to you to deal with me and to do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage itself, that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those that I would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. May I do your will always. So we thought well before taking this step, making sure that we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. And I don't know exactly what happened, really. But I know when I left there that morning, my life hasn't been the same since. It was as if I'd been on the dark side of the street all my life, and now I'm walking on the sunny side, just like that. And my life hasn't been the same. And I have been allowed to do things that I never dreamed. I didn't have enough money to get out of town on when I drank it. But today I've got enough to retire if I want to. But that's another story. But God has done for me in my life what I could not do for myself. My wife and I got back together, and ultimately she got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and been sober for 25 years, thank God. You see, as I said the other night in our meeting, my house today has become a home because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and God is in our home. Thank God. It all started right there with step three.
We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. And I think the word utterly means completely, wholeheartedly, all the way, the complete ball of wax. I hope you don't make the mistake I did the first time I took step 3. I got down on my knees, which I very seldom did in those days. And I said, God, I offer myself to Thee to deal with me and do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, and so on, so on, so on, so forth. And as I finished it up, I said, now this applies to my alcohol. Don't fool with my sex life. Stay out of my money. I can take care of that too.
God probably said, what an order. I can't go through with it.
I said, you take the alcohol and I'll take the rest. And today I realize the fallacy in that is God probably doesn't even drink. You know, I don't think He wants the alcohol. I think He wants me. And I think He wants all of my thinking, not just part of it. Just think, if God directed all of my thinking, then my life might become better in all areas. Not just regarding alcohol, but it might even get better sexually. It might become better economically. It probably would become better in all areas. We abandon ourselves utterly to Him. Also, it says we found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. We are tri-dimensional creatures. We're meant to live with God, with ourselves, and with our fellow human being. And we pray in the company of other human beings, we're fitting ourselves back together as God intended for us to be in the first place. You know, we alcoholics are the funniest things in the world. We let our family see us in the bathroom every morning on our knees, hugging the porcelain bowl, puking our guts up. We come to AA and we start trying to do something about our life, and we're embarrassed to let other people see us pray. Prayer has a much deeper meaning and is longer lasting and taken in the company of other human beings. Back in the beginning of AA, there was never any doubt about this. When they made their surrender, especially in Dr. Bob's house, two or three of the older members took the new member upstairs. They all got down on their knees together, and the older member made their surrender, which is our step 3. And then after it was over, the newer member made their surrender, which is our step 3. And after it was over, the older members voted on how well he surrendered. If it wasn't good enough, he'd probably have to go back and do it again. They always prayed in the company of other human beings. Very, very good idea, I think. We're getting ready to take a break, but I want to ask you a favor before we do that. You don't need to do this if you don't want to, but as a favor to us, I'm going to ask you to reach out to the person on each side of you, hold their hands. I'm going to read this prayer again. I'm going to read it line by line, and as I read it, I'm going to ask you to repeat it for me. If you don't want to do it, feel free not to, but I'm going to ask you to do it. God, I offer myself to Thee.
God, I offer myself to Thee.
To build with me and do with me as Thou wilt.
To build with me and do with me as Thou wilt.
Relieve me of the bondage of self.
Relieve me of the bondage of self.
That I may better do Thy will.
That I may better do Thy will.
Take away my difficulties.
Take away my difficulties.
That victory over them may bear witness.
That victory over them may bear witness.
To those I would help of Thy power.
To those that I would help of Thy power.
Thy love.
Thy love.
And Thy way of life.
And Thy way of life.
May I do Thy will always.
May I do Thy will always.
Amen. You'll never have to worry about whether you've taken step 3 or not. You just now took it. Thank you all. Let's take about a 15-minute break. We're going to jump right into step 4. We'll do the resentment part of step 4 in the next hour and a half. Okay. Everybody ready? Let's get on with it now. We've made our decision. We're getting ready now to start taking a little action in order to carry out that decision, to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand it. Bottom of page 63. It says, next we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. The first thing we always like to look at is the time element between step three and step four. We hear this question asked quite often. How long should you wait to do step four after you've done step three? And we hear all kind of answers. 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 6 months. We heard a professional in the field counseling people to wait a minimum of 2 years. And our question back to that counselor was, how many people have you killed with that statement? Now, we're trying to find a way to live where not only can we be sober, but we can be peaceful and happy and free so that we can remain sober. And every day that we put off on step four, every day we procrastinate, is another day we remain restless, irritable, and discontented. Another day we stay filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. Another day that we don't feel good. Another day that we're becoming closer to the idea of taking a drink in order to feel better. And I don't really know how many days I could go under those conditions. Frankly, I'm not very interested in finding out. The book tells me when to take step four. Said I should take step four at once after step three. And that does make sense, doesn't it? Four's always followed immediately after three, as far back as I can remember. And there's good reasoning behind it. If we do the best we can in step three, that's going to remove just enough self-will to allow us to get on with and get started with step four. And if we don't get started with it, then after a while, self-will comes back and says, we really don't need to do this. And after a while, it says, we don't dare do this. And we continue to procrastinate and put it off and put it off and put it off, and every day becomes more difficult. And the basic idea is to take it at once after step three. Now, knowing that, and knowing we might get drunk if we don't do it, then why would we continue to want to procrastinate? And I think maybe two or three reasons behind that. Number one, a lot of the older members like to play king off of the mountain with this step and tell the newcomer how tough it is. My God, you just wait till you get to step four. Yeah. Just literally scare them to death with it. Let us be the first to say today, if we do step four the way the big book says to do it, there's nothing to be afraid of, period. And I think we're going to be able to see that here in just a little bit. Another reason we tend to procrastinate on this thing is simply we did not understand how Bill writes. And not understanding how he writes, the instructions are here on page 64, but they're so short and simple that we alcoholics, with our keen intellectual alcoholic minds, looking for something more complicated, have overlooked the simplicity of it, and we didn't understand how he intended for us to do it. So we continued to procrastinate. Then we looked over in step five, and it said something there about sharing all your life story, and we said, oh, yeah, that must have been what they wanted then, for us to write our life story for step four, and then share it with another human being in five. That's what I did to begin with. Now, my life story probably wasn't too important to other people, but it must have been to me. It had 92 pages in it. I took it to another poor, suffering alcoholic, and he read it and said, "Not very pretty, is it?" And I said, "No." And he said, "You'll never have to be that way again." Threw it in the waste paper basket. And I learned nothing to contribute to my alcoholism from the writing of my life story. As I look back at it today, 95% of my life story has nothing to do with my alcoholism anyhow. The fact that I was born in 1929, I don't think it's got a thing in the world to do with my alcoholism. May have with somebody else's alcoholism, but not mine. The fact that I went into service immediately after graduation from high school, I don't think it's got a thing to do with my alcoholism. The fact that I was married at age 21, I don't think it's got a thing to do with my alcoholism. But I'll tell you what it did do. The 95% that had nothing to do with it very effectively covered up the 5% that did. And I could see nothing from my life story to contribute to my alcoholism. So in her confusion, somebody in Dallas, Texas wrote a 4-step inventory guide. We took the Dallas guide, tried to combine it with a big book, and we got more confused yet. Somebody in Minneapolis, Minnesota wrote a 4-step inventory guide. We took the Minneapolis guide, combined it with the Dallas guide, combined it with a big book. We got more confused yet. I have no idea how many of them are floating around out there today. We saw one that had 20 pages in it. I guarantee you, if you wasn't crazy as hell before you took it, you would be when you were through with it. It was one of those kinds. All the time, the instructions have been right here. We got to remember that Bill loves to use an example of something we already know about to teach us something new. He's going to talk to us about a business inventory, assuming we know something about a business inventory. And then he's going to turn right around and tell us to do exactly the same thing with our lives that he just told us to do in the business inventory. The other thing we must always remember, he loved to use word comparisons. He would use a word here, and he would use another one over here that means basically the same thing, rather than repeat that word over and over. Now, bearing those two things in mind, let's see if we can't see how simple this thing really is. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. And immediately, he goes to business. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. And if you had a business, and I don't care what it is, selling ladies' purses, men's watches, bicycles, or anything else, if you didn't inventory in that business, you wouldn't really know how you stand. You wouldn't know what's been sold that you didn't get paid for. You wouldn't know what's been stolen from your store. You wouldn't know what's become damaged and unsaleable, and it's sitting there taking up floor space. You're probably paying borrowed interest on borrowed money to buy it in the first place. You wouldn't know what's become out of style. You need to put it on sale and get rid of it. If you didn't inventory in a business, you would probably end up going broke, and I think we can all see that. Well, I think his first comparison is this, comparing the personal inventory to the business inventory. We have a business in our personal lives. It's the most important business in the world to us. It's the business of finding a way to live where we can be sober and be peaceful and happy and free and not have to go back to drinking. And if we don't inventory in our personal business, we're probably going to go broke also. So whether it's a business inventory or a personal inventory, in either case, we're probably going to go broke without it. Now then, he's going to tell us how to take this commercial inventory. Taking a commercial inventory. Now, he could have said business again, couldn't he? But he don't like to use the same word twice, so we'll call it commercial this time. Taking a commercial inventory is. Now, we're going to take a few key words out of the big book. And we're going to put them up here on the screen, and our friend Glenn here, Joe's a good example. Glenn's the bad example. So that's why we got him facing you. See?
Glenn likes to take our inventory.
Glenn's going to do this for us as we go along. And we're on this sheet we're putting up here. It has business inventory on one side and personal on the other. And we're going to take a few key words out of the big book and list them under our business inventory. He says, taking your personal inventory is a fact-finding, and we're putting fact-finding under business, and a fact-facing process, and we're putting fact-facing under business. It is an effort to discover the truth, and we're putting truth under business, about the stock in trade, and we're putting stock in trade under business. The stock in trade, that's the items we have in that store for sale. The ladies' purses, the men's watches, the bicycles, whatever they might be. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods. We're putting damaged or unsaleable goods under business, and to get rid of them promptly and without regret. And we're putting get rid of them promptly and without regret under the business. In other words, what we're really looking for is the stock in trade that is damaged. The good items do not cause us to go broke. The good items sell day after day after day, and we make money on those. The things that will cause us to go broke is the stock in trade that is damaged. Nobody wants to buy it, and it's sitting there taking up valuable floor space, valuable shelf space. Now, is there anybody that would have any problem with what he said about a business inventory? We're going to go in there and we're going to try to find the facts. When we find them, we're going to face the facts. We're trying to discover the truth about the stock in trade. The object is to disclose the damaged and unsaleable goods. When we find them, we're going to get rid of them promptly and without regret. We're looking for the damaged material. Anybody got any problems with that? Okay, watching. He wrote a step for us using a series of words which mean basically the same thing. In our fourth step, he said, we made a searching. And we're putting searching straight across from fact-finding. They mean the same thing. To search out the facts, to find the facts. We made a searching and fearless. We're putting fearless straight across from fact-facing. They mean the same thing. We made a searching and fearless moral. And there's where we got in trouble. We said, oh, there it is. There's that list of dirty, filthy, nasty items. And we don't want to look at them. We sure don't want to show them to somebody else. Now, I'm not really sure what all Bill Wilson knew, but I know this. This guy understood the English language. And I really believe if he'd wanted you and I to make a list of dirty, filthy, nasty items, I think he would have said, we made a searching and fearless amoral or immoral inventory. He didn't say that. He said moral. Bugged us and bugged us and bugged us and bugged us till we went back to the dictionary. Moral is defined in the dictionary as nothing more than truth. The right and wrong of any given situation, the facts as they really are. So moral and truth mean the same thing. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of what? Of ourselves. We're the only stock in trade that we have in this business of staying sober. Nobody else can make us sober. Nobody else can make us drink. Oh, I'll admit they can make us thirsty as hell once in a while, but nobody else can make us drink. We decide whether we drink or not. Now, what part of us decides whether we drink or not? Is it our body or is it our mind? The real problem centers in the mind telling us we can drink rather than the body that ensures we can't. So I'm going to look into my mind, and I'm going to find those flawed thinking processes that blocked me off from carrying out the decision that I made in step three. Now, those flawed thinking processes, when I find them, I'm going to get rid of them promptly and without regret. It's only when those thoughts are gone that God's thinking can take their place. Now, we've already talked about what those flawed thinking processes are. A selfish, self-centered, self-willed human being will always display three common manifestations of self. Number one is resentment. Number two is fear. And number three is the guilt and remorse associated with the harms done to others. So as I begin this inventory process, I like to look at my head up here as just a little bitty store. Just a little bitty one, not very much in it. Maybe a little Quick Trip or 7-Eleven or a Get and Go or
Come and Get It.
I saw one the other day said Come and Get It. So whatever it is they got to offer, I don't know what it was, but and up here in this little store, I've got some display cases over here, and they are filled with resentments. Damn him. Damn her. And by God, I'll show them. And they're not going to treat me that way. And I'm going to get even with them. And the next time I see them, I'm going to do this. And the next time I see them, I'm going to do that. And blah, de, blah, 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 blah. God can't get in those display cases. I'm sorry. He is very effectively blocked out of there by those resentments. Over here in this part of my store, I've got a little file cabinet, and it's filled with fear. Oh, my God. What's she going to do when she finds out about this one? Oh, my God. What's the boss going to say when he finds out what I've been doing? Oh, my God. What's the banker going to do when that check gets there? He already told me he'll file on me next time. Oh, my God, is that my car sitting out in the front end torn up? I don't even, oh, my God, and on and on and on. God can't get in there. He's very effectively blocked out by those fears. Back here in the back of my store, I have a little storage room, and it is filled with guilt and remorse associated with the people I've hurt in the past. As we've said before, we are not drunken bums. We have a conscience. We know the difference between right and wrong. When we're out there drinking, since alcohol lowers the inhibitions, we do many, many things drunk we would not do sober. When we come to ourselves, the guilt and the remorse and the fear associated with those things just literally eat us up. God is very effectively blocked out of that storage room. It's already full. He can't get in there. So if I want God to direct my thinking, then I'm going to have to do something about the removal of these things, open my mind up so God can enter and begin to direct my thinking. My book is getting ready to show me just exactly how to look at these things, just exactly how to see the truth behind them, just exactly how to get rid of them. And the most important thing of all is going to show me how to keep them from coming back in the future. And it's only when I've done my part that God can begin to direct my thinking. The book says, if the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We're going to have to be just as honest as we can possibly be with ourselves. Now he said we did exactly the same thing with our lives. In other words, doing in our own personal inventory what he just told us to do in the business inventory. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. We've been not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. When a spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. So I think now before we start to set resentments on the paper, let's look at the word resentment itself to see what it really means. The word resentment comes from two old words. One of them is the word re, R-E. And any time you see R-E or re before another word, it simply means to do again or to do over. Like repaint, redo, re always means to do again. The last part of that word, sentiment, comes from an old, old word called sentire, which means to feel. So the word resentment itself means to re-feel, to re-feel, to redo, to replay. Okay, let's say we're going through life, and we must always remember now that other people have got the same basic instincts of life that we have. Other people are always trying to fulfill the social, the security, and the sex instincts. And sometimes those people, through being sick in those areas, they do something to us that threatens one of our basic instincts. Maybe they put me down in the eyes of other people and threaten my self-esteem. Maybe they rip my money off and threaten my material security. Maybe they do something to threaten my sex life. And people are going to do that. Now, when they do that to me, that's not a resentment. That's a wrong on their part for doing so. It does not become a resentment until I go off in the other room. I go across town and sit down in my easy chair that evening, and I replay that thing they did to me in my mind the second time. Now, the stupidity in it is this. The first time they do it to me, it hurts. And that's their fault for doing that. But when I go home and sit down in my easy chair and replay it in my mind, and I hurt myself the second time, then I'm doing it to myself. They're not even there now. And after a while, I'll replay it again. And I re-feel that pain and that old hurt the third time. And then after a while, I'll replay it again. Now, I've noticed something about me when I replay these things in my head. I'm not always too honest with myself. You know, only God knows the truth. We human beings know the truth as we perceive it to be the truth. And my perception is not always right. I find that what I tend to do is every time I replay this resentment in my head, I make what they did just a little bit worse. I make what I did just a little bit less. And I make the pain just a little bit deeper. And you let me play that sucker in my head long enough, then I'm able to stand there and say, well, I was just standing there doing nothing. And they came along and did it to me, and it's all their damn fault. That's why we love to play resentments. You know, I kind of look at this looking at resentments as watching a football game. You guys love them up here just like we do at home. And in a football game, every once in a while, you'll see one of these guys get hurt. Maybe he jumped up in the air to catch the ball, and while his feet's off the ground, man, they've learned that's when you hit him. Maybe you can knock him loose from the ball. Turn him upside down, and he just falls down on his head, and his legs split apart, and his arm goes behind his back, and he's laying there on the ground, and you can see that he really is hurt. Now, when that happens to that football player, one of two things will take place. The game is going to go on, just like the game of life goes on. One of two things is going to happen. They're going to run out there and check him out. And if he isn't hurt too bad, they'll pump a little air into him and get him up and they start playing the game again. If he's hurt too bad, they'll drag him off to the side, they'll put somebody else in his place, and the game starts over again. But the guy up in the booth, this announcer up here, he's got a resentment machine. Because after a while he says, let's look at that again. And he'll play it over, and this time it is in slow motion, living color, and it looks twice as bad as it did the first time. Man, you can see how far his legs did spread apart, how far that arm was really bent, and you can really see the pain and the suffering. And after a while, the announcer will say, let's look at that again. Now, the game's been going on for 15 or 20 minutes, and the announcer's sitting over here bouncing this guy up and down, up and down, up and down off the ground. We alcoholics have in our head a little resentment replay machine. And we get up early in the morning and we tune that machine up in living color. We clean the lens on it because we don't want to miss anything all day long. We shine it on the world all day long. And we record all those things they do to us that is bad. We don't record nothing good. We're not interested in that junk. We record everything they do to us that's bad. We go home at night, sit down in our easy chair, play it over in our head, make ourselves sick, and blame it on other people. There's times, though, we have a bad day. There's times we got her tuned up in living color. The lens are clean. We're shining it on the world all day long, and they won't do anything bad to us. Now, that's a bad day for an alcoholic.
Bad.
When he has nothing bad to record and go home and replay and make himself sick, you know what we record those days? By God, we record what they're thinking. That's what we do. And we go home and replay that and make ourselves sick. There's a bad thing about it, resentment. When you play it over and over and over and over and you keep throwing it out there, sooner or later, it's going to turn right around and come right back at you. When it comes right back at you, it's going to come back at you as self-resentment. And we begin to resent ourselves for being in a position for those things to happen to us, and we can't stand self-resentment. So after a while, self-resentment turns to self-pity. And my God, we alcoholics love self-pity. It is a sick, sick way to build your ego. You know, after all, if the whole world is picking on you, you must be pretty important to start with. And if you don't think we love self-pity, you try feeling sorry for one of us. Hell, we will tell you in a hurry, don't you feel sorry for me. That's my damn job. We love these. Is there any way that God can get in a mind filled with that kind of crap? We've made a decision to let God direct our thinking. And if we've got those resentments floating around in our head, and we're playing them over and over and over, then God can't direct our thinking because the thing we resent is directing our thinking. So if we want God to direct our thinking, we're going to have to do something about resentments. They are the number one offender. They block us off from God more than anything else does. And in order to be able to get rid of them, we've got to see the truth behind them. Now I'm going to make a statement. And remember, I've made it. If you got a resentment in your head today, it is not true. It is not true. It may have started with truth, but it's not true. And if we want to get rid of it, we've got to see the truth behind it before we can get rid of it. And that's what my book is getting ready to show me, just exactly how to do that. Page 65 is the example that we use to do the resentment part of the inventory. And one of our problems is that it was already filled out and we don't know the procedure that he followed to fill it out. So what we're going to do, and we've given to you, and where did Glenn go? We've given to you a sheet that has five columns on it. And we would ask you now if you're going to use your sheet to either cover up or fold under the last two columns. Three says affects mind. And we want to emphasize now, we're not trying to bring another inventory into AA. We got enough of those already. This is simply page 65 in the blank form. Now let's see if we can find the directions on how to fill that blank form out, Joe.
And then we set them on paper. Well, we've got the three columns, we've got the paper, now we're ready to do this. But remember, we're taught to read from left to right, always. And if we read this from left to right, we would read in the first column, I'm resentful of Mr. Brown, and I changed my mind to go to the second column, write down the causes, and I changed my mind again and go to the third column, what part of self was affected. And I change my mind again and come back to Mrs. Jones, back to the second column, the cause, and what part of self was affected. If you do that very much, if you have a mind like mine, it goes tilt. You know, and say, well, hell, they don't want all that in there. What they really want is all my life story. So I just strip over that and forget it. But you see, I think, and we think, we talked this over quite a bit, and we think that because the instructions are in the book, we do this one column at a time from top to bottom, while our mind is on one thing and one thing only. And if you look at the layout of page 65, you can see that it's pretty dang simple. And I believe that simplicity is the key when doing the inventory. Simplicity. And I'm like Charlie, I'm going to reiterate, we're not going to psychoanalyze ourselves. We're not going to say the reason we're the way we are is because Mama set us on the potty training chair backwards and all that stuff. We're simply going to find the facts. We're going to face the facts. We're engaged in a process to accept the facts. So it says, in dealing with resentment, we set them on paper. We listed people, institution, or principles with whom we were angry.
Period.
Stop right there. We go to the first column, and while our mind is on one thing and one thing only, we write down from top to bottom, leaving a little space, just like Bill did, the people, the institutions, or principles with whom we are angry. Period.
While we've got our mind on one thing and one thing only, let's make this list from top to bottom. People, that's self-explanatory. Institutions are those things such as the police department, the Internal Revenue Service, the federal government, the church, etc. Principles are those old, old guiding, I hate to use the word laws, but I don't know anything any better, that we've heard all of our lives that interfered with our style of living. Ten Commandments are a set of principles. And when I was out there drinking, I don't want to hear nothing about the Ten Commandments. I'm breaking all of them except one, and maybe I'm breaking it during a blackout. I have no idea. Another old principle I always hated said, what you give out is what you get back. Another one said, there are no free rides. You'll pay for what you receive. There's one my dad used on me. I hated it then. I hate it today. He said, son, when you lay down with dogs, you'll get fleas on you every time. All of those old sayings that we've always heard that interfered with our style of living. I've never known an alcoholic yet who did not know just exactly who and what, by God, we're mad at. We spend hours sitting around in bars talking about it. The only thing we have to do is take it out of our head, put it down on a sheet of paper. You don't have to be sober very long to do this. You don't have to be highly educated to do this. If you can't write, you feed the names to somebody else and have them write them down for you. Now, you'll notice Bill used four names. Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, my employer, and my wife. He probably had more resentments than that. I assume he just didn't want to use any more space in the book. They came to me and they said, make a list of your resentments. And I said, I don't have any. And they said, oh, surely you do. Let us explain a resentment to you. And I explained it was to refill those old pains and hurts and angers. And I said, oh, yeah, I got a couple of those. And they said, well, put it down on a sheet of paper. And I got a sheet of paper, and leaving that space in between the names, On a standard size sheet, I got about 8 names on it. And I reached over and got another sheet of paper. Next thing you know, I had 8 more names on it. And then I got another sheet of paper. And next thing you know, I had 8 more names. And then I got another sheet and another sheet and another sheet. And I got up to about 152. And I said, man, you're madder than hell at everybody. I did not know that. You can only see one resentment at a time in your head. I don't think any of us will ever know how many resentments we have, how much they rule and control and dominate our thinking until we get them all down on a sheet of paper and see them in their entirety for the first time. Now, we've made a decision to let God direct our thinking. And if we've got that many resentments, then those resentments direct our thinking. God can't, and it's just that simple. So I learned something very valuable just by filling out the first column. Now let's look at the second instruction.
So we ask ourselves why we were angry, period. Go to the second column. And you notice in the second column that Bill only used 3 or 4 or 5 words to describe the cause. Simplicity is the key. For instance, what's the cause of him being mad and resentful at Mr. Brown? Well, his attention to my wife. Told my wife of my mistress. Brown may get my job at the office. Now, I don't even know old Brown, but I can get a little mad at him myself. He does that for me. Now, Mrs. Jones, well, she's a nut and she snubbed me. She committed her husband for drinking. He's my friend and she's a gossip.
Put his best buddy in the state insane asylum. That's what she did.
Unreasonable. His employer's unreasonable, unjust, and overbearing.
Probably said, Bill, where were you all day Monday anyhow?
Yeah. He then threatens to fire me for drinking and padding my expense account. Very narrow-minded individual. Now, he's really mad at his wife. Why is that? Well, she misunderstands and nags, and she likes old Brown, and she wants the house put in her name. All you have to do is start tying a little bit of that together and wanting the house put in her name and liking old Brown. It's time to get upset.
Time to get a little upset. Yeah.
So in the second column, simplicity is the key. 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 words is all we need to describe the cause.
There may be only one cause. There may be multiple causes. But we simply put it down in just a few simple words. As I filled out the second column, I learned something that turned out to be very valuable. I begin to realize it's not them I'm upset with. It's what they've done to me that's got me upset. I could take Mr. Brown out of here and put Mr. Green in. If Green does the same thing, I'll be just as upset with Green. I could take Mr. Jones out of here and put Mrs. Smith in. If she does the same thing, I'll be just as upset with her. I could take my wife out of here and put my girlfriend in. I'd be just as upset with her. I begin to realize it is really not them that's got me upset. It's what they've done to me that's got me upset.